I am very happy to be able to welcome Professor Jeffrey Leach at our Fragile Next series of lectures. I think I don't need to introduce him. Actually, this is the biggest ever audience we have had for Fragile Next series of lectures. So I think this by itself indicates that Professor Jeffrey Leach is our most welcome guest, and that we are really happy that he could accept our invitation. Actually, I also should say that this is not the only purpose of his stay in Prague, that in addition to another lecture we will have tomorrow at the conference at the Faculty of Philosophy, the most outstanding event of this week for us and for Professor Leach will be his promotion as the honorary doctor of Charles University on Thursday afternoon in Aula of Carolinum. So, without an official curriculum vitae, I would like to mention here one event or one thing which I suppose characterizes both Professor Leach and his relations to us. It's a kind of personal, a piece of personal memory, of my personal memory. Professor Leach wrote a very nice introduction to semantics. And the book was published in 1974. And on page, on page 59, there is an extract from newspapers, which is introduced by a small paragraph. It's a it's a part of a the chapter which is called Position, and the introductory paragraph looks like this. A more extensive illustration will be provided by the following paragraph from a leaflet dropped on Czechoslovakia by the Warsaw Pact authorities at the time of their military takeover of the country on August 21st, 1968. And there is a quotation from the leaflet. This is not the end of the story, as you can suppose, because in 1975, Professor Leach was supposed to come to Prague and Brno and Bratislava, if I'm not mistaken, on an exchange visit organized by the British Council. And shortly before that visit, Professor Jan Firbas from Brno called me and said, please come immediately to Brno. And so I went to Brno, which wondered what had happened, because I traveled to Brno every second month for some discussions on topic focus articulation. And at that time, I was told by Professor Firbas that if the visit of Professor Leach is endangered because some good colleague read this book and pointed out this chapter to somebody somewhere, and the invisible eyes said, oh, such a person cannot come to Prague or to Brno, I cannot give a talk. Fortunately, Professor Leach did come. It was quite a courageous trip, actually, because he got the visa, as I learned today, only at the Prague airport. But this is, even this is not the end of the story, because we told the story to Professor Leach when he was in Prague and when he was in Brno, and he then recognized what he did. And at that time we didn't have the book. So when Professor Leach came back home, he sent me a copy of the book, But this page 59 and 60 was missing. Professor Leach was so nice as to understand the problem, and he didn't want to endanger us, so he just threw out the page. I must say that I am very, very sorry that somehow at that time I didn't understand the importance of the moment, and I bought another copy afterwards to have the page. And I threw out that wonderful copy without the page. So that's the end of the story. So I think this is a wonderful illustration, not to speak about other books we got from Professor Leach, this comprehensive grammar of English and quiet grammar of English, etc., etc. So our contacts are very long, very fruitful for us, and I'm really happy that Professor Leach is with us and will give us a talk. Please take the floor.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Eva, for that very nice introduction. Can people hear me? Can you hear me? Yes? Okay. I want to begin with a few words about Fred Jelinek, after whom, in memory of whom this series of lectures are held, well, I can't pronounce his name very well in Czech, so I just call him Fred Jelinek, which is what everybody used to call him when I knew him. And, of course, he was a brilliant engineer. He was a language technologist and a brilliant statistician. And I got to know and admire him in the later 1980s when he was at IBM's research center in New York State. In some ways, he was not an easy man to work with, but he made the decision to fund our research at Lancaster for 3 or 4 years, and for that I was very grateful indeed. We were building tree banks. Tree banks, I suppose you people in this institute know them very well, and from your own superb work in that field. And of course, he championed the need for corpus-based natural language processing. For a long time, he was regarded as an outsider by the computational linguistics community, because he was data-heavy and theory-light, whereas they were mostly theory-heavy and data-light, I think. And eventually, of course, his approach won the day, and computational linguistics was converted to his point of view. So I pay that great tribute to the man in whom, after whom this series of lectures is named. And I last met him here in Prague, in my last visit to Prague in 2002, I think. Yes. Well, I'm afraid my contribution to this series does not relate closely to his work or even to the current work of the Institute here. After retirement, I retreated from NLP to corpus linguistics, which of course has a core of NLP in it. One of my main research interests today is in what Manfred Krug called brachychronic linguistics, short-term diachronic linguistics, comparing or using comparable or matching corpora. And this is, of course, dealing with the recent history of language using a corpus, often a distance of a few years, a decade, several decades, but not taking the great panorama of history, which is what diachronic linguistics has traditionally done. So I hope you'll find this talk interesting, although it may not relate very closely to your own research interests. And the topic I'm going to take today is on why things seem to decline and perhaps eventually disappear in language. Why do features of language change? Of course, a lot of attention is always paid to new developments in the language, the way new items are created and the way they spread through the language. But very little attention has been given to the way things disappear, decline, and perhaps disappear. So I want to have a look at those things, looking at the very relatively recent history of English. A I'm going to focus here on corpus evidence for decline in frequency and some likely reasons for decline in frequency and the mechanisms of change themselves. See what we can learn from using corpora for this purpose. I have a lot of acknowledgements to make to colleagues who have worked with me on this area of corpus linguistics in the last 12 or 14 years. I don't have a list of references for people to read, but I'll just give one reference, which is this book that I, together with some colleagues, published in 2009 on change in contemporary English. Right, now the evidence is mainly using what is known today as the Brown family of corpora. Comparable corpora of American English and British English at roughly 30-year intervals. It all began way back in the 1960s with this well-known corpus. The Brown corpus was the first electronic corpus of English, or perhaps even of other languages, to be created. And in Lancaster, we started a matching corpus of British English. So this was originally just a synchronic comparison between two varieties of English in the 1960s. And because that was the beginning of using computers to study language, we could only manage to produce a corpus of 1 million words, which sounds a lot, but actually is quite small by present day standards. And it was all written data, because in those days it was very difficult to store spoken language in any form on the computer. And then, about 30 years later, the people at Freiburg University in those days, Christian Meyer and Marianne Hund, decided to create a new generation of matching corpora. So they were designed to be completely, as precisely as possible, equivalent in the way they are sampled and the way they are structured, equivalent to these corpora here. So we then had a nice quartet of corpora. And since we like to use the family metaphor, being a generation apart, we called them the nuclear family, if you like, a small family of corpora. Since then, this nuclear family of these four corpora has extended in various ways, not very systematically, really. There's a corpus that we built at Lancaster called Before Lob, or Blob for short, 1931. We even started one for 1901. And later on, these yellow corpora here, a colleague of mine, Paul Baker, at Lancaster, built those, but he used simply the web. He managed to collect a corpus which was in every respect similar, identical to these, except for the period of, in this case, 15 years later, using the web as a source of data. Now, there might be some questions about whether this is as closely comparable to the other corpora because of that fact that they were data collected from the web, which doesn't necessarily mean that they were in all senses equivalent. But we do find them, we haven't found any reason not to trust them as a good representation of the written language of that recent period. And then these green ones here, they are incomplete, but we managed to use this one a little bit because we can sample across the whole range of texts up to a third. We haven't got really more than a third that we can play with, but that's something that can usefully be used, even though the amount of data is rather small. And so this is what these corpora are made up of. We tend to divide them into 15 genre categories. There are 500 text samples, 15 genre categories, and 4 subcorpora, as we call them. For most purposes, we don't really want to go to a more delicate stage of genre categories. We just talk about verse, general prose, which is non-fiction prose writing, learned or academic, and fiction. So those are the main categories. Fairly broad range of written language. And so we try to use these as representative in some sense of the written English language of their period. Of course, it'll be the standard language because they are written form, in written form, and in fact they are published materials. So in that sense, they are only dealing with written standard English. Now, just to give you a flavour of what English was like at the beginning of the period we're dealing with, which was 1901, I just give you a short sentence to give you that feeling. It's not the kind of English we would find very frequently today. The second purse shown here is knitted with some of Messrs. Pearsall's twisted silk, upon which beads of a suitable colour have been threaded. While you take it in, I'll just explain that this is a text from a category dealing with skills, trades and hobbies. And I don't think anybody would publish a book of dealing with how to... I think it's something to do with knitting or... knitting. It's a kind of knitting guidebook, if you like. And I don't think the same style would be used today. One of the things that I come back to is that the passive is used here. And the passive is one of the phenomena which has been declining and which I'm going to talk about further. This form message is a bit odd. It's a plural of Mr., which I don't think would be used today. Upon, as a preposition, has declined a great deal since that time. And again, we have another passive. So you might consider this a matter of style. I can't point to any features of syntax there which do not exist today. But nevertheless, the character of the English language has changed considerably over that 100 years. And we're interested in studying it then, primarily in terms of loss of frequency. That's what I'm looking at today. And the six case studies, I hope I have time to deal with all six of them. First of all, the preposition upon. Secondly, the conjunction for. Thirdly, the passive voice. Fourthly, WH relative clauses. Fifthly, modal auxiliaries. And sixthly, prepositional phrases. Have a look at these. They're all on the decline and have been for some while. But some of them, of course, are very much more frequent than others. And so they'll show this phenomenon of decline in a somewhat different way between them. Let's start off with upon, and this is the kind of chart which I'm going to show you. The blue line is the British English, because actually we have got five data points with the British corpora. We've got 1901. I had to scale this up to 100% from about 33%, but let's say it's approximately correct. Then we have 1931, 1961, 1991. And of course, this 2006 is only separated by 15 years. So because I was not very clever with PowerPoint, I couldn't find out the way to cut the space here. But I hope you'll be able to imagine that this is only half the distance of that and that. Okay, so you can see how upon has declined almost to become a rarity in present-day English, from being very common. This figure simply tells us the number of occurrences per million words. So it's a rough and ready measure, really, of the extent to which these words are, this particular word is used in the present and in the recent past. Now, one of the things I noticed when we studied the poem was that today it's very frequently used in what one could describe as idiomatic or fixed expressions, or what I call here lexically bound. That is to say, a poem is bound to another word in some sense of being bonded to it in terms of frequency. So, if you call upon, the use of a poem there is connected with the fact that it's in this prepositional verb construction, to call upon. And similarly here, decided upon, the verb goes with the preposition. It's also possible to say call on and decide on, but somehow the preference is to use upon in these fixed expressions. And you notice again with impact upon. And of course, you take these are very much the fixed end of the scale, the fixed expressions where it's very difficult to use the simpler preposition on, once on a time doesn't occur, I think. And Stratford upon Avon, again, is conventional because it's in the name of the place. There are also lexically free uses, as I would call them, where the use of upon doesn't seem to be connected with any particular fixed expression. We have example here, upon this point the British foreign policy has never altered. Okay, so when I plotted the frequency of upon, here this, we're talking from 1931 to 2006, and this is British English, when I plotted this, and I also plotted the number of lexically bound uses, you see that there's a large predominance of the lexically bound uses. And on the whole, that proportion of lexically bound uses increased. The lexically free ones are just the ones in this short, this narrow gap here. So one theory is that when linguistic forms decline, it's because they get more and more restricted to fixed expressions. In some sense, they become lexically governed rather than syntactically governed. Well, I thought that was a very good argument until I found that here there's a slight increase in the amount of proportion of lexically bound forms in 2006. So that was a pity from my point of view. Okay, so that's one idea. Now, another way to look at this, instead of just counting the occurrences per million words, is to look at the proportion of upon, comparing it with the preposition on, which you can think of as a variant of the same variable. You say there's a variable here, including both on and upon. Upon is perhaps a more formal and weighty preposition, but in general you can substitute one for the other without too much difficulty. And so if you do it that way, you get a slightly different picture, but the message is the same. In red we see this is the proportion of upons over 10% in 1931, but very much lower than 5% in 2006. So in that sense, upon can be clearly seen to be on the decline compared with its alternate form of on. And on, as we see, actually increases in frequency, and that also is in a sense shown by this diagram. Now I'm going to another word, the word for, which of course is frequently used as a preposition in English, but in this case we're looking at for as a conjunction. And two examples here. This is from Lobb, which is 1931. A proprietary remedy should be used, for this is better than any homemade one. For here is a conjunction subordinating, normally considered a subordinating conjunction, but its status as a subordinator is somewhat unclear because it can only follow the matrix clause. You couldn't, for example, begin this first sentence with for this is better than any homemade one. But on the other hand, if you use because as an alternative causative conjunction, then you could begin the sentence with because. With this one, this is rather interesting, for seems to have become more independent, as if it can introduce a new sentence. As in this example, for how is the good citizen to be defined, blah, blah, blah. Okay. And this shows that for has been moving more to paratactic rather than hypotactic linkage. So in that sense, it's a somewhat unusual subordinator or subordinating conjunction. And here's a picture of the way for has declined from 1931 onwards, right the way down here. This is British English. And for American English, we don't have the earlier corpora yet, so we can only measure the decline over this last 50 years or so. But nevertheless, you can see the picture is very clear. That decline is taking place, and it's taken place very steeply indeed, in almost getting to the stage where for is an archaism, perhaps. Its use is so limited. Now, I thought it was possible that for is declining. Part of the reason, at least, for the decline of for might be that other causative conjunctions are increasing and somehow taking over the use of for. And so I looked at because, and this is the most common causative conjunction in English, I think. And, so what we find here then is that because has indeed increased over the last 100 years or so very steadily. It seems to be increasing more steeply towards the end of the period. And one possible reason for that is the process known as grammaticalization, which diachronic linguists have written a lot about and theorized a lot about, the process whereby originally lexical combinations have become reduced to some sort of grammatical function. In this case, you think of because as ultimately coming from by cause of. I'm not into the history of it now, and this takes us back hundreds of years to Middle English, but that process of grammaticalization, of getting reduced into a single form, has continued, and we often find in speech these days that it is pronounced as a monosyllable. In fact, as a reduced monosyllable, just 'cause. I know Marie likes me because she told me. That's a very common way of saying it in present-day English. And of course, if you transcribe it, often it gets transcribed by this single syllable cause. And that's an indication of further grammaticalization. It's also a signal that perhaps because is used more in speech than in writing. And indeed, we did find that to be the case. It's much more common in speech than it is in writing. And given that spoken forms of the language tend to extend themselves into the written language over time, the process which we call colloquialization, whereby the written language adopts spoken language habits, then we also expect this increase to affect the written language. And so this evidence provides, this provides evidence of that. Now, because, of course, can be used at the beginning of a sentence as an introductory conjunction with the subordinate clause preceding the matrix clause. And so you could get, because they were so large, she felt a bit afraid of the griffin. You can put it that way in English. But because it's getting more and more to be the kind of conjunction that follows the matrix clause, the number of cases of because preceding the matrix clause is rather small. And so that's another reason for thinking that because is somehow taking over the function and the territory of for. And this just shows the same sort of picture, but showing that American English is on the same track, but a little bit higher up in the increase of because. Again, we only have got the three data points for American English, so we don't quite know what the picture was before that. But we very often find that American English is somehow leading the way, somehow the British English is following the same track, but somewhat behind the American tendency. If you like, we are more conservative in the old country. And this is another picture of a similar kind. This is showing us because, and it's also the abbreviated form cause, but this is actually from the British National Corpus, which contains spoken material. So we have a 10 million word subcorpus, which is the spoken data of the British National Corpus. And on part of that, the so-called demographic part, which is really English conversational style and dialogue, we can actually find out the ages of the people who are speaking in most cases. And so we can draw this graph representing what is called apparent time. That is to say, it's not really diachronic, but it tells you, in terms of ages of people, what their usage of the particular feature we're studying is. And we see that older people are using because less than younger people, right? So when we get to starting off with people who are 60 plus and going up to a peak at 15 to 24, and it comes down a bit dealing with people from 0 to 14, children. And now I'm not sure how to explain that, but it could be simply a limitation of the corpus. British National Corpus was not really collecting material from children. It was meant to represent adults, and children only came insofar as they were talking to adults who were using this recording device. And so it's a little bit unreliable as representing the character of children's speech. So if we just conveniently forget about that one, we can see the general picture of increase in the use of because represented by the ages of the people, and how that usage has increased with younger people are. The yellow line simply represents the whole of because plus the reduced version represented in dialogue as cause. We don't really know how much to rely on that, because of course it was a decision made by transcribers who are often not particularly professional to represent it either as because or cause. But the picture is quite interesting, because we see a regular decline in the use of because. So in spoken language, the full form because is decreasing, but the reduced form cause is increasing up here, which of course is a sign of further grammaticalization, because grammaticalization often shows itself in a phonetic reduction and merger of forms. And so the yellow line shows the complete picture of because plus cause. Okay, so that's a kind of theory, or a hypothesis, if you like, that for is declining in part because of the increase of because, and this picture simply represents them both together. Here's the line of because, here's the line of for. This is all British English, by the way. And another causative conjunction, since, when it's used as a causative conjunction, also increasing. And another one, as, which is not increasing particularly. So we go to four different conjunctions, which are to some extent, or considerable extent, overlapping in their function. And it's interesting to see whether we can explain the decline of for in terms of the increase of other conjunctions. Well, it doesn't quite work out numerically, as you probably see from the diagram here. The decline of for is more extreme than it would represent by the increase of because and of since. But at least there seems to be some reason for that being part of the explanation of for. Now we move over to my third topic of decline, which is the passive, the be passive in English. This table simply represents a small part of the total picture. It's what's happening to British and American English between 1961 and 1992 in this case, 1991, that's an insignificant difference. So we're just looking at 30-year change in the use of the passive in British and American written English. And we see that there's a decline of 20% in American data and slightly less, 12.4% in the British English data. So this represents a very typical picture that American English, not always, but quite a lot of the time, you find that American English is changing faster than British English, and it's also somewhat ahead of British English in that particular process. And what I mean by being a bit ahead is, if you look at the figure here, this is the figure for frequency of the passive in the American Brown Corpus from 1960, and that's almost identical to the frequency of the British Corpus FLOB from 1991. So, just a generation ahead, as it were, the Americans are going faster and further than the Brits. Be interesting to look at the bigger picture. So I move to the bigger picture now, and so we see a decline. We can trace it back to 1931 and up to 2006. If we remember that this is not a true representation of 15 years, actually we would see a sharper decline here than the diagram actually shows. And once again we see the difference of American English has declined further and is still a generation ahead of British English in the decline of the passive. Now, of course, the interesting thing to which we would like to discuss insofar as we can is why are these things happening? Historical linguists have often avoided the question why, simply because it's too difficult to answer. But let's try and answer it anyway and see how we get on. One of them I've already mentioned, one type of explanation. These are really explanations for increase in frequency, and so they're not obviously applicable to the decline of frequency that I've been illustrating. The first one then is grammaticalization, the process of turning lexical material into grammatical material. And I'm going to show you another example of that, those so-called semi-modals, like be going to, as a future, as a quotes, future tense, which has been developing in English. And then we have the process of colloquialization, which I've already just mentioned briefly, adapting written language towards spoken norms. So the theory here is that a lot of change actually takes place in the spoken medium, but then it, after perhaps a time lag or so, it gets converted into the written form. Not always, but at least to some extent that happens. And one example of this is negative contractions, or in fact verbal contractions generally, the fact that we can use cannot or can't. We can use the contractive form. And traditionally, everybody's been saying that can't is the form that is used in speech. And if you're writing English, you shouldn't use the contraction. You should use the full form, cannot. And similarly with will not, won't, and so on. But what we find is that there's a great increase in the use of these verbal contractions in the written language, and this has been increasing over the last 100 years at quite a steady rate. And so, one explanation for that is this colloquialization, the way in which written English gradually adopts the habits of speech. And then I've mentioned also Americanization, the fact that British English, being a smaller and more conservative country, nevertheless is influenced by American English. And American English follows a particular pattern, and we find that British English often follows it after a short time delay. Did you guys eat yet? Actually, we don't use this kind of expression in British English yet, but I expect we will soon. We certainly use the word guys a lot more than we used to when I was a young student. Okay, and then we come to densification of content. Packing more meaning into less space. For example, press headlines. PM slams later party leader. PM is of course a brief for Prime Minister. Slams is a brief word meaning attacks verbally. Labour Party leader, of course. It's a very concise way of expressing meaning, which we get superbly in press headlines, and which we also find in press writing generally. News writing tends to have this densification effect, which we also find extending to other varieties of English, not just journalism, but to other forms of written language and even to the spoken language. And we'll have a look at that later on. And there are other possible facilitators of change. Prescriptivism. For example, using the relativizer that rather than which. I'm going to come to that one in a minute. And democratization, for example, we no longer make such use of Mr. and Mrs. Miss. Those have been on the decline a lot because people are now using a method of address simply by first name. And in fact, when I went to Starbucks Coffee in Prague last night, they asked me, what's my first name? As if that's important when you're buying a cup of coffee. But I discovered that the reason is that they can then write your name on the cup, and then you will get the right cup of coffee, hoping that you don't have the same first name as somebody else. So here we have the habit of first name address standing all over the place. And that word messers, you know, which I showed you in that illustration before of 1901 English, hardly ever used. It's plural of mister. So we have various explanations. Some of them are socially driven. Most of them, in fact, are driven by social factors, I think. But grammaticalization is an exception because that's also driven by internal factors such as elision, ellipsis, and a merger of linguistic forms. Right, we're returning to this one, restrictive relative clauses, another apparent case of colloquialization. So, if we look at the first two, the woman to whom you were talking and the woman you were talking to, the equivalent ways of expressing relative clause, but, of course, we can use the one so-called piping construction with the preposition first, or the so-called stranded preposition construction with the preposition end. Now, which of those do you think is increasing and which is decreasing?
The second one.
Second one is increasing. Right, you're right. Yes, this one is increasing. And more significantly, this one is decreasing. And then we come to these three here. You can use which, that, or sometimes you can use zero relativization. We say the matter which you mentioned, the matter that you mentioned, the matter you mentioned. times. So which of those do you think is decreasing?
It is there.
Which?
The third one is increasing.
Right. Third one is increasing. What about this one? Which?
Decreasing.
Good. And what about that one? Do you think it's increasing?
Decreasing.
I have caught you out at last. Okay. You got most of the right answers, but not over that. And what is the reason for that declining? This is the interesting point. There's a so-called sacred that rule. In Zwicky's language log, 2005, that's his American English, he wrote a really brilliant attack on what he calls the sacred that rule, which is the rule which has been enforced by language gurus, people who have authority, quotes, over the language in the USA. They may be editors of journals, they may be teachers of freshman English in colleges, they might be people who write articles in newspapers about how to use your language. But these people collectively have enforced this so-called sacred that rule, which says, in a restrictive relative clause, thou shalt not use which, thou shalt use that. And you find that if you use modern word processors, you know, word for windows, that sort of thing, if they often tell you, you know, do you really want to use which? Oh no, you shouldn't use which, you should use that. And so we see the decline of which. This is looking at which. And we see the decline in British English. American English, we only have the three data points, but we see the same trend. And of course, American English is further ahead in this decline than British English. But there's a strange kind of figuration. It looks like a pair of nutcrackers or something, this lozenge-shaped pattern here. And that is interesting because I think that shows real American influence, because American English really felt the force of this decline in the period 1961-1990. British English, not particularly influenced, but suddenly it was influenced. I'd say suddenly. I mean, the influence in British English seemed to come later, as if British English is now waking up and following the American lead. And American English is still declining, but not so steeply. And the reverse of that picture is found with that as a relative, right? The matter that you mentioned. We see American English is far ahead in the frequency of that as relativizer, and it was particularly steep in 1961 to 1991, but still continuing. And British English, not very noticeably increasing at all until the period after 1991. So again, after a time lapse, the British English follows the American lead. Now, last, not my last topic, but about time.
Five to 10 minutes,
okay. I'll try and cover the last few topics rather quickly. Declining frequency of modals and the growing frequency of semi-modals. Here I've compressed two trends in one diagram. I'm showing you here a declining frequency of modal auxiliaries, by which I mean the central class of modal auxiliaries in English, will, would, can, could, may, might, shall, should, and must, and ought to as well. They have declined particularly since about 1960s. And there's another class of verbal constructions which have modal function, but they are increasing, at least rather slowly, and I call those semi-modals. Other people have used different terms, like Krug called them emergent modals, a slightly different class. They're not very well defined. I think the British English modal class is well defined, but the semi-modals not so well defined. I just choose 9 different semi-modals here. And, well, you see, British and American English are more or less the same there. But in this one, again, you see the familiar pattern of American modals declining faster and further ahead in that pattern than British English. I here use the corpus of Mark Davis. I don't know if any of you looked at this corpus of Mark Davis's called COHA, Corpus of Historic American English, an enormous corpus which you can consult online in his on his website at Brigham Young University. And here we find the same pattern. Actually, the decline only really seems to have set in later in the 20th century. But that's American English. And if we look at particular, these are in British English actually, particular modals, we have will, may, must, shall, just examples. These are modals which have been declining particularly fast compared with others. Some others are remaining more or less the same. And I won't spend much time on this, but particular reasons why we might say these are declining, particular modals which are declining, like need, needn't, he needn't have worried, you ought to remember. We shall demonstrate. And one of the reasons is that there's so little you can do. They are so inflexible. There's just one form you can use. And they're almost like an invariable particle. You know. And you can't use them as a finite verb anymore. And shall also has another symptom of this decline, which is that it can only occur in limited contexts, like the use of shall as a first person subject, and also with third person subjects, but only in rather legalistic contexts and different types of texts. So these are only found in particular parts of the corpora I'm concerned with. Right, so if we take must as a particular example, must has been declining very steeply, and again we see that American English is ahead of British English. But, and sorry, this is need. Going on to need to. Now this is a very different case because need to is a finite verb construction. It's one of what I call the semi-modals rather than of the pure modals. And we also have to and need to. In a way, these are apparently taking over many of the functions that used to be earlier conveyed by must. I'm not saying must is dead or anything like that, but must is gradually being superseded, I would suggest, by forms like have to and need to. Have to goes up like this in British English and then comes down a bit, which is quite an interesting thing, maybe a challenge to explain. One possible explanation, because must have to, on the whole, has increased enormously over the last 70 or 80 or 100 years, but maybe it's coming down now because of the increase of need to. This is the one down here. Need to is increasing such a lot, and maybe in that sense it's competing with have to as another way of expressing obligation or necessity in present-day English. Okay, I won't spend any more time on this, but just say it's very difficult to find data which can do similar comparisons with spoken language, but there is the diachronic corpus of present-day spoken English, of British English, that is to say, which was created at the Survey of English Usage in London under Professor Burke originally, and then by Sidney Greenbaum, and then by Baz Art, present-day successor to Quirk. And they have produced this diachronic corpus, not enormously large, but it's a spoken language, which is difficult to find any other data of the same kind. There's no American corpus that can do the same thing. All I show you here is that between the 1960s and 1990s, we have decline of modals, and the rise of semi-modals is much more commensurate with the decline of regular modals than you will find in the written language. In the written language, we found that the semi-modals were only increasing slightly, whereas the modals were declining quite significantly. But here we find similar amount of change. And so probably in speech then, the semi-modals are taking a much more significant part in the expression of modality than was true of in the written language. Right, I think it's time for me to stop, because if I spend time on densification, we won't have time. So I want to just briefly describe what happens here. We've got increasing density of nouns. This is in press, supremely in press, but also in the other varieties of written language, and even in the spoken language, this increase of density of nouns. And you see it in the way you get noun-noun sequences. Just look at an example like this. The fruit of the coconut palm would be expressing the idea by use of prepositional phrases. Coconut palm fruit is using the genitive, which has also increased a lot, and using simply noun juxtaposition, you can simply say coconut palm fruit. These are roughly equivalent, but of course there are a lot of cases which are not equivalent. Just to show you how this type of expression has been increasing, go to this picture of noun-noun sequences. American English, British English, in this case somewhat catching up the American habit. Noun-noun sequences are increasing. And prepositional phrases are decreasing. We see decline of prepositional phrases up here. British and American English more or less the same. And increase of noun-noun sequences here is compressed into a smaller band, frequency band, so it doesn't look quite so dramatic. But you'll see the general picture, that just as the prepositional phrases are decreasing, the noun combinations are increasing. So that brings me to my last point. Why? The evidence considered today is consistent with the assumption that the declining use of linguistic forms is simply the negative side of processes which lead to the increasing use elsewhere in the language. The positive determinants of change, such as grammaticalization and colloquialization, are explanations for positive change, which indirectly may provide explanations for negative change. That's my conclusion. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for your most interesting and stimulative talk. I think we all will go back, or will bring back home one thing, that's how to carefully use corpus evidence and how to look for explanation for any of the corpus evidence. So thank you very much. Okay. Thank you very much for that. Now I will open the floor for discussion from the audience. Yes, Sylvia?
Do you think that the present-day English is that the non-native speakers contribute to the changes of the present-day English by the vast amounts of texts we are forced to produce in English?
Well, for my own research, of course, I've been focusing mainly on native speakers' varieties, so I can't say very much about that, actually. But I think it is quite likely that that is happening, and that it will happen more in the future. You know. There are various movements which could promote that kind of change, and one of them is interest in what is called ELF. What does that stand for? It stands for English as a lingua franca, right? So a lot of English in the world today, a great deal, proportion of the English used in the world today is used talking between non-native speakers. And so it stands to reason that that variety tends to dominate in terms of frequency, and perhaps it will make an influence upon the way the language is used. I don't yet have any clear evidence of that, but Europe is a good area in which to make that kind of study, I think, don't you? And there's another sign which I remember my friend David Crystal, he's written a lot about this sort of thing, you know, and he said that he thinks it very likely that over the next, I can't remember the way he actually expresses this, but the coming tendency will be for English to develop more syllable timing rather than stress timing. You know, people always say it's a stress time language, right? And because a lot of the non-native speakers using English around the world, for example in Africa and in Asia and in some parts of Europe, are syllable timed language, then they will eventually, as it were, outperform the native speakers. But I'm not so convinced of that. I mean, it's very difficult to think ahead, isn't it? But so far, I don't find very much sign of this. But I mean, there are small things like in European English, people use the word irresponsible as a noun. And that seems to become quite established, for example, in EU fundraising. I am responsible for this. But that is not a native speaker expression. So in some respects, you might say non-native speaker in a small way is increasing there. But I'd like to invite other people with suggestions on that. So if you have any ideas, let me know.
There was one information in your slides which surprised me, because what I can observe in the papers our students write or abstracts, as non-native speakers of English, I can observe a quite evident tendency in using a noun-to-noun conjugations.
Yes. Oh, right.
And I must say I fight against that, because I have the feeling that this is a kind of influence from American English, I
Could
thought.
Yes.
But on your data, you have one of the slides shows that this is not so, that the noun 9 sequence is not that much more frequent in American English than in British English. So
exactly,
I don't.
Yes. It seems as if British English is catching up a bit. It would be nice if we had an earlier period for American English, because this noun-noun sequencing habit is often attributed to American journalism. American newspapers towards the beginning of the 20th century developed this habit, and ever since then it's been catching on and spreading its influence. Another corpus linguist, Douglas Biber, written about this, he says that there's a cut-off point, what's the word, a kind of ceiling, at which it's no longer functionally appropriate to increase noun-noun sequences, because you're fighting, there are two forces actually. One of them is what I call densification. And the other one is colloquialization, which is to make it more like speech. Now in speech, this densification is counterproductive. You cannot express your meanings in a way that other people can easily decode. So his idea is that to make the message accessible, you cannot go too far along this track. But if you want to compress your information, because after all, we live in a world of information explosion, we have to somehow cope with enormous amounts of information, and one way to do it is to use this compression strategy. But the compression strategy works against the accessibility of the method. That's one idea.
In one of your slides, you actually showed that the rate of disappearance of modals is faster than the rise of semi-modals. Does that mean that actually expressing modality in this way is decreasing in English? This is one question, and something that has something to do with it, maybe has something to do with it. This is quite a new information. A couple of weeks ago in Nature, in the scientific reports in Nature, there was an information, actually, a finding based on Google Books, which may not be the best reliable source and so on, but it's very extensive. The finding was that the rate at which words are disappearing from English is consistently increasing, while the rate at which new words are introduced into English is consistently decreasing, which means that our language would be poorer and poorer and poorer. So I don't know whether this has something to do with it. I don't know. They did not draw any conclusions based on findings, but it's a very interesting trend that, according to them, lasts from the 19th century up to now.
Well, I'm just mystified by your second report about decreasing neologisms and increasing obsolescence of words. I'm just extremely surprised, and you know, I wouldn't know how to interpret that, or even whether to believe it or not. But going back to the first one, really, your question was, where have all those modals gone to? Because if the core modals are declining, and the semi-modals, which look like a replacement or a competing paradigm of verbs, like be going to, have to, need to, want to, all those, you know. So they are increasing, some of them are increasing a lot, but others are not particularly increasing. And they don't seem to be making their way very much, at least compared with the decline of modals. They are not making their way into the written language. And, I tried to find the answer to this by looking at other lexical, mainly lexical expressions which express modality, like is it necessary or obligatory, a lot of nouns and adjectives which do express modality in a less frequent form. On the whole, those are not particularly frequent, and I made a long list of those words and found that they were actually decreasing, quite contrary to my expectations. So you cannot really say that, well, those missing modals are being expressed by new expressions of modality which have not been taken account of in those verbs, those verb constructions. So so that's not the answer. Part of the answer, at least I think, is colloquialization combined with grammaticalization. Now, we think of grammaticalization as taking place mainly in the spoken language, where you get those reductions, things like gonna instead of going to, and be going to, and wanna instead of want to, and so on. But that's a typical effect of grammaticalization, which we find with these semi-modals. So they are increasing because grammaticalization is associated with increase in the frequency of of the forms which are being grammaticalized. And so if that is happening in the most informal styles of English speech, then you could argue that the deficit of modals is due to the fact that it takes time for that effect to filter into the written language. So Grammaticalization explains why this competition is getting more severe, as it were, from the semi-modals. But colloquialization explains why they are reaching the written language, but not to the same extent as the spoken language. So that might be part of the explanation. I've just mentioned in this connection that I made a study of mediumly large corpora of spoken English. Which one of them is the spoken part of the British National Corpus, BNC. The other part is the Longman corpus of spoken American English, which is roughly comparable to the British corpus collected under the same circumstances. By comparing those, I found that in that most conversational and extemporary style of English, the semi-modals were very, very much more frequent than in the other corpora that we looked at. So those growth of be going to, want to, and if you like, gonna, wanna, gotta, have to, all those forms are increasing enormously in American conversation, such that they are very frequent. We can't tell whether they've increased from that data because it's not diachronic, but they're very, very frequent in that spoken data, which is actually from the 1990s. And so if you think that must have increased in spoken American English, often we think of spoken American English as the bellwether of new usage. You know, new things come from American speech. So it may be that these other effects are being indirectly coming from American speech, but they don't show that same dramatic increase that we find. Just to give you an example, I mean, must, which is a good traditional modal for expressing obligation and necessity, is less frequent than, it's an American conversation, less frequent than have to, got to, and need to. Those three are much more frequent ways of expressing obligation and necessity than using must. So that's the way things may be going. But I also think there's an effect which I sometimes call, prestige barrier. Okay, prestige barrier. The prestige barrier is still a residual feeling which people have that written English is more serious and more standardized, and it should be more serious and standardized than speech. So a lot of the forms which occur in speech do not easily get transferred to written medium. A classic example is the verb get, which probably everybody who's gone through an English education has been told, don't use get in a written form. You know, somehow reserved for speech. It's felt not to be serious. It's too colloquial to come into written medium. And that might be also true of gotta, because that comes from get or so. And some other forms like you better go. Those are so colloquial that they don't even get into written form through colloquialization. So various ideas, but no absolute answer to that.
Which concerns the causative conjunctions.
Yeah.
Have you, the data you have given us seem not to be dependent on the position of these connectors in the sentence. And when I started to learn English, I was instructed not to use because at the beginning of the sentence.
Oh, really?
Yes. I'm sorry. Now I can see it in texts which I read, but still, it just when I saw all these four possibilities, because seems as four, I mean, are the frequencies relative to the positions, or does it mean that, for instance, because disappears or stays stable and scenes is also used within a clause or something like that?
Well, as far as I remember now, this represented only because following the matrix clause. I think that was true. Because otherwise it wouldn't be equivalent to, it would be a different function from 4, you see, because it can't begin 4. And I think that's true also of these. So I don't think I counted, included those initial clauses. But I think that rule of yours is interesting. Don't begin a sentence with because. Because I think that the reason for that is that in spoken language we often begin as if a new sentence, even a new utterance, with because. You say, get me a cup of tea, because I'm thirsty. And because it begins almost like a new sentence. And that's, of course, it's not considered to be good written English to begin a sentence, which is actually, the whole sentence consists of a because clause. There's no main clause. That's considered to be wrong in written language. So that might be that the reason for that rule. I've heard that rule being used in English education, and I think it's because people in speech actually do use because, I call it hypertactic. It's obviously linked to the preceding context, but you begin as if a new utterance with because.
There are no experts in the discourse annotation among us here, but I remember we had a workshop in Philadelphia just a week ago with people who annotate discourse connectives or connectors like Joshi, Bonnevere and others. And I think they also had a very, very low frequency of because at the beginning of the sentence. I mean, of the sentence as such, only at the beginning of a clause, which is inside a compound sentence. So, I mean, I took that observation which they had as a kind of support of my teachers who taught me not to use because at the beginning of the sentence.
Well, I said that I believe, has become more paratactic link rather than hypotactic link. That's the difference, really. And so we get very few initial becauses which contain a subordinate clause followed by the matrix clause. We get three of those, but we get many becauses with capital B, particularly in transcribed speech, for example, where there's no main clause following. The post clause behaves like a main clause. Yeah.
So, if there are no questions, I would like first to thank Professor Leach for coming and giving us a wonderful talk, and for all the regular or irregular participants of our Monday seminar. I would like to say that this is the last one in this academic year, because next Monday many of us local people will be in Istanbul for the Language Resources and Evaluation Conference, and we will open again in October, the 8th of October, again with Fred Jelinek series, and the guest for that talk will be James Puskiewski from Brandeis University. So I hope to hear many of you again at that lecture. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.